Hey, everybody. Welcome to Glitchy Pancakes, real talk about the world of fandom. I'm Allie.
I'm Rob.
I'm Jesse.
And today we're following up on some hot topics in the world of genre publishing. We have with us the author of more than 40 published short stories, 11 novels, and 3 active speculative mystery series. Also the founder and publisher of Mocha Memoirs Press, a publisher of excellent and diverse speculative fiction. Welcome, Nicole Givens-Kurtz.
Hey, Nicole.
Hey, how you doing, Nicole?
Yay!
Thank you for coming on. We kind of asked you on a little bit of short notice because there's been some pretty big news the last couple of days in publishing, and we wanted you as both a writer and a publisher to want to hear what you think about it.
Great. Yep.
Yeah. So we appreciate you being here.
On our last episode, we started out talking about Audible Gate with John Hartness, and I was just going to give a quick recap of what happened with that. So basically, Audible, owned by Amazon, is pushing people to use their monthly subscription service instead of purchasing individual books. And so you get the subscription service, you're able to borrow one book for free and then get further books that month for a discounted rate. However, they are actively encouraging people to exchange a book if they don't finish it. Now, they can also exchange a book if they do finish it. They treat the exchange like a return, which means that they don't pay the author anything. They don't pay royalties on it. Even worse, they've been concealing the fact that they're doing this on their royalty statements by only showing net purchases rather than showing purchases and then returns on separate lines. Mm-hmm. So fun.
Yeah. And they've been allowing people to do that for it's like 365 day return policy, right? Like,
right. Yeah. Right.
They basically kind of made it into, they're trying to make it into a subscription library on the backs of authors and publishers because, mm-hmm. Yeah. Then they just don't have to, like, if someone buys a book, reads it, exchanges it out for the next one, you know, you just kind of, you know, keep it going like that. But then they were, everybody that gets returned, that gets subtracted. Oh, yeah. Right. So, Nicole, how were you feeling about that when this news accidentally came out? You know, it's not like Amazon or Audible came out and published this. It accidentally got out. So what did you think when you found out?
My hair caught on fire.
Yep.
I don't have a lot of Audible titles. Like, we just started out like this year with getting books and like Audible books. However, the idea of not disclosing gross sales, right? Because my Amazon reports have that. They have, here's what's been purchased. Here is a column for what has been returned. Mm-hmm. And here's your net. So the idea that you don't include that, the gross amount, is just, A, it's unprofessional. And B, and it implies, right, that there's some sort of hidden agenda or some taking out of its cookie jar underhanded, right?
It looks super shady, right?
Oh, all day. And it makes you question like all of this. So if this is inaccurate, what is, right? You have doubt in the platform, you have doubt in the accounting, you have a gazillion questions around the legitimacy of your product that you're pushing out to customers and the money that you need to get back, right? So,
yeah. And I didn't even think about the fact that you mentioned that it doesn't show you your gross. So that would make it like you as both a writer and a publisher, it's probably really important to you to know, like, even, yeah, if people are returning stuff, that's fine. But you really need to know how many people are finding it in the first place, right?
Yep.
Like, that's super important numbers.
Right. If you can't see that, like take, for example, our Amazon reports, they're very, they show you, so I say, for example, I had an item that just did not sell. Like, lots of people had checked it out, and this actually did happen once. A lot of people had, it was in the Kindle store. It was in the Kindle Unlimited, and people were just like, and then they just didn't like it. You could just tell, like, they just didn't like it. Their reviews weren't great, but you also, the buying, people who actually bought it versus, because they don't have Kindle Unlimited, mm-hmm. The return rate was really high for this title. that's an indication to me as the publisher, hey, we need to either look at that title, see if it's formatted right, see if something happened during uploading, like to investigate. We don't right. even have that option with Audible, right? Because we don't see, we can't tell by the number of returns if, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, how many you've sold. Yeah, like you could yeah. have sold 50 of them, and as long as 51 or more weren't returned, in other words, like from a different month. If you sold 50 this month and you know, all of them get returned and one more, you still won't, you just think you sold zero.
Right. Right. It's also really frustrating too, is that they're trying to make it a lending library yeah. or have lending library options when that's not what initially what the platform was designed for. Right. It's a retail yeah. store. And so that, that in of itself, it's two different, like there's, so
it's all
like,
right.
hey, we want you to use our platform because it's so awesome. Right. But we also want to not pay you for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we talked last time about how a lot of people get, like, if they're using is it ACX, whatever, if you're
yeah,
like,
yeah, it's ACX exclusive. Yep.
Yeah, if you're entering and that's the audiobook creation exchange mm-hmm. so that's if I'm not mistaken, the contracts that people get into with them for using them exclusively is 7 years long. So what they yep. did, like you were saying, is they created this as a platform. They sell authors and publishers on the platform. We're fantastic. Mm-hmm. We have the biggest reach. We'll put your stuff out there. You have to pay to make it. You got to pay to actually get the audiobooks recorded and all yep. that. But then we'll give you a platform. And then they changed it. They switched to this new format, which was not what everybody agreed to in the first place, but they're still in contract for 7 years.
Yep. And ACX was bought by Amazon. Amazon bought them.
Oh,
initially. Wow. Yeah. So I think ACX was its own little entity, if I'm not mistaken. And then Amazon bought them. And then, so again, this is another example of, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, of companies saying, hey, you guys are doing something great. You're making a great impact. We see a profit there. We're going to buy you, and then we're going to squeeze it so that, you know, so we get as much of a profit margin as we can. It's just right. absolute greed. And it discourages me. It discourages other authors from the arts. It happens in the arts a lot where people are like, oh, we have this really great idea. It gets a platform. People love it. And then some big conglomerate comes in or some larger company comes in, gobbles it up. I'm not mad at ACX for selling it, right? Mm-hmm. But then they pivot, or they squeeze as much of the of profit margin as they can get, as opposed to honoring what that platform was originally established for.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, Amazon doesn't need any more money.
Right.
No, like, they literally owned by the world's the richest person in the history of humanity.
Like, you just don't you can't, need any more money.
Like, that makes it even worse. Like, it's owned by the richest person who's ever lived, and yet still trying to do some shady accounting just so that people, you know, just to try to hide a couple of dollars from authors. Like, yep. Yeah, you're right. Pure greed.
You know what I like to do? I like to get my hand on one of the contracts and just take a look at it, or, like, you know, allow someone like Jesse to take a look at it and mm-hmm. see what he sees, because I can't understand still yet how they can lock them into a contract like that and then completely change the format to where they're basically giving their content away for free.
And the messed up part about that is that, you know, they pay their attorneys well. So that, right. this, that absolutely this decision went through their legal department, like everything does. So they know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It looks like there was zero consideration given to whether it's ethical, and all the consideration given to, can they get away with it legally?
Right.
Like, oh yeah, absolutely.
That was the sole decision. I mean, I wasn't in the room, obviously, but I'm pretty sure that was their sole, like, decision point. Right. So there's been some updates since then. That's why we're talking about it again, because
yes,
since the last time we talked about it, Audible sent out a couple of lovely emails to their authors and publishers on this platform. A lot of happy, you know, warm and fuzzy stuff about how they really value this community and everything. And
the way pig farmers value, you know, the way people love bacon value pig farmers, right?
Right.
Like,
exactly.
We love you, Farmer Bob. Thanks for the bacon.
Mm. Exactly. Like it's super nice. I mean, it says things like, and we're getting most of this information, by the way, from stuff that Susan May, the author, has been writing about it. We'll put the link in the show notes if you want to get some much more thorough detail of all of this. But some of the stuff from the email on November 12th, they apologized and offered to pay for the month of December to pay an additional 5% royalty on all sales of ACX audiobooks through Audible, Amazon, and iTunes. Susan May points out they ended with a heartfelt, ACX would be nothing without you, the creators of more than 200,000 audiobooks that have delighted listeners for the past 9 years. You know what? They're correct, but put your money where your mouth is. So this whole thing of paying an additional 5% royalty on all the sales in December, Susan May points out a couple things about that because first of all, they're not providing any transparency. People have been actively asking, like, give us better royalty statements that show us, you know, what what's actually being sold in return. They're still, they just ignored that. And she points out that if you're still allowing this return policy, then that extra 5%, last time I think I did the math on this, 5% of nothing is nothing.
Jesse, before you go any further, can I ask you a question?
What's that?
So, did you just say that in the letter that they sent to people that they love the content creators and the content creators have been providing content for them for the past 9 years?
That's what it says. Yeah. 200,000 audiobooks.
Where in a place in the world do you have to be to mention that and not go on the other end of, well, you've been stealing from them for that amount of time.
Right.
The power behind saying that in an apology letter to a community you've been ripping off and then telling them, hey, we've been doing this for 9 years. We know people love you. We've been making money off. That's the most arrogant shit I've ever heard in my life.
It is. And it's so dismissive.
I digress. I apologize. It is very dismissive.
So just for clarity's sake, I believe ACX is technically its own company, but it's right in the same building as Audible, just as a, you know.
How long have they been affiliated?
They're in the same building and all of that, but technically they're a different.
But
Audible was purchased by Amazon in 2008.
So. Okay.
Yeah.
I can't.
Okay. I just can't.
Yes, it stands, Rob. For all of those years, they were stealing from the author.
That is wild. Mm-hmm. Continue, Jesse. I apologize.
No, that's fine. A couple more points they make is that, still no mention of the returns breakdown. So they're still not giving people an idea of any of that. They're also doing a thing where the second thing they sent out. This was November 24th, I think, where they said that. As of January 1st, Audible will pay royalties for any title returned more than 7 days following purchase. So that looks good on the surface, right? They're saying, okay, well, instead of that 365-day thing, we'll pay you royalties for any title returned more than 7 days after it's bought. They're waiting till after Christmas, which is very much the busiest time of the year to start doing that. Also, they make no mention of repaying money that they've already been taking for all these years via all of this. This gets a little bit technical here, but this is Susan May goes into detail about what she calls the pot theory, which is maybe not what it sounds like at first. Although I think somebody
far less entertaining than you.
Although I think somebody might have been a little high when they wrote those emails that they sent out to authors.
Bing. There it is.
So what it basically means is, I'm not going to break down all the math. This is laid out in great detail on this blog post that we'll link. But basically, when Audible subscribers spend credits, the authors and narrators don't know the exact royalty dollar value, and they're not told how Audible calculates this stuff. Like, they're not the value of credits and things like that. They have this really complicated system that they don't explain very well, if at all. And what it basically means, from the best anybody can tell, is that there's a certain, like, these things, like these credits and stuff, it goes into a pot that is divided up among the authors that are part of the service. So what happens then, she breaks down the math on this, is what happens is that if you're dividing the pot to pay out on the credits that are spent, then what happens after the returns after 7 days still get deducted from the pot of money that is shared by everyone. So it's still lost to authors. They do a breakdown on, you say, 10 subscribers, $15 a month, and how it breaks down. It actually ends up with the author getting the same or possibly slightly less in this new setup that they're talking about with the 7 day return policy, because then again, it's very complicated. It's laid out on this blog post, but basically it doesn't help anybody. It's nope. It's not an improvement. I'm sure you got that email, right, Nicole?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I totally did, and was like, swing and a miss.
Yeah.
It just,
it was a big swing, right? Like, I mean, they definitely made it. The whole thing, it seems shady to me again, because it seems like they're like, well, if we just say we'll pay you royalties and everything after 7 days, that's going to look great. A lot of people will be mm-hmm. happy with that. They know exactly how this is going to break down financially, and they know they're not spending a single extra dollar this way.
They're not. No.
Yeah.
They're not fixing the problem. They're still taking the majority of every sale. They haven't fixed anything. They're just trying to be all warm and fuzzy about it and make it look better. So, yeah, like you said, swing and a miss. They really... they have not made this right.
And for anyone who didn't listen to the first episode, they're already paying not nearly what they should be paying to the creators on these things. The most an author is getting on them is 40%. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if they are not exclusive to Amazon, to Audible, then they get 25%.
Yep.
So they're already taking 75%, even though the publishers and authors are taking the upfront risk and paying the money to produce said audiobooks. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just solid greed, right? So what, Nicole, do you have, what do you think would be, what do they need to do? Like what would you think would be a fair setup? Because clearly the previous one was very unfair and they hid that fact. The quote improvement that they made in the last couple of weeks, not an improvement. So how do you think this should be set up? I mean, from a perspective of an author or a publisher, what do they need to be doing?
Well, first they need to be transparent.
Yeah.
There's that. Two, they need to look at their contracts and revise them to their more ethical and equitable for both for the creators. And I think like those are two really big steps that need to happen. If they're going to allow their consumers to, return books for any reason, even with the idea that I listened to this whole 400 page book and I don't like it, then I think, because that happens with Kindle Unlimited as well, people can return their books. But I definitely think that the royalty rate should be increased if they're going to do that from like, to where it should be, like where it is with ebooks, like 70%.
Oh yeah, I didn't realize there was that much of a gap between them.
Yeah, so for ebooks, they're like 70% royalties. I definitely think they should increase that if that's the way they're going to do it. I personally think they should not do that.
And even with Kindle Unlimited, you get paid by the page read. So even if someone returns it, but they read 50 pages, you get paid.
That's right.
Oh, they could at least do that, right? Like they could at least be like, oh, well, you listened to 30 minutes of this. So,
I definitely think people should get paid for for the work that they provide. Mm-hmm. Money should always go to the creator. Mm-hmm. So that 25%, or in my case, because we have someone produce, the narrator usually produces the audio stuff for us and do all the work. So we do like a split royalty rate. It's even less. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that first make the contracts ethical. Be seriously consider if you're going to do returns, they, make people pay for what they've listened to.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
People are going to, sometimes people pick the wrong thing. That happens, right? To err is human. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to get this great holiday audio book, but it's super erotic about Krampus and Santa Claus. So I'm going to give it back. That's fine. Like, we understand that. But if someone listens to an audiobook, people need to be paid. That's just ethical. Right. So that would be a start in respecting your creators. Yeah, somewhere on that list, start respecting the creators to buy content for your business. That would be awesome.
Yeah, there's just like there's Rob's right. There's a lot of arrogance to it. Like just because there's such an imbalance between mm-hmm. the creators and the platform, you know, like they feel like they can do absolutely anything because they're providing a platform for you to sell stuff. But they, I mean, that's all they do is provide the platform.
Yes.
You write the product, you get it recorded. Like they don't, John Hartness on the last episode was telling us that like, they won't even reformat anything. Like they won't reformat your cover art. They don't do anything but sell it for you. And sure, that's valuable. A platform to get it out to more readers. Great. But it's not that valuable. It's the same way that, I mean, look at the dude at the top of that food chain and, you know, being worth about $160 billion. And don't worry, I'm not going to go off on a whole rant about this, but there's no way that his work is worth millions of times more per hour than any other person who's doing work. Like it's just, there's a value to the platform, but it's
Jesse
not.
Jesse would like you all to eat the billionaires is what we're hearing.
Hey, I don't think I've made a secret of that, and I have.
If you're a like trillionaire or a really high, if you're a billionaire, you're not using your powers or your funds for good.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Batman.
I'd totally be Batman.
You have money to like improve not just yourself but the world, and still be extremely wealthy. You should do that.
Not only extremely wealthy, continuously extremely wealthy, like. There's not a day, a second goes by that you don't make money. Mm-hmm. Like you continuously make money every second someone buys something from Amazon. Every time that happens, that's more money for you on a mm-hmm. massive scale. If you can't do something with that, I don't know what that speaks to. It speaks to something that's beyond us.
You don't get to be a billionaire by being a nice guy. Sorry.
I've come to understand that more and more.
Yeah.
That you have to have a kind of a drive or an instinct to do this, but there still has to be something there. I mean, morally, there still has to be something there.
Somebody tweeted recently, I was trying to look it up just now, I can't find it, but they were commenting that basically Jeff Bezos has drones, he has all the money in the world, and he's got access to all the products in the world. He's actively choosing not to be Santa Claus.
Have to send, you know, like tech gifts. He could actually give people water who don't have water. Yes. I mean, seriously, like,
yes.
You if remember he, when people were out wait. Of toilet paper, you could have solved that. I mean,
if he wanted to at any given time, he could end poverty for a lot of people.
Yes,
absolutely.
Hunger.
You want to talk about, you know, he should have been a beauty queen, and he could have said that he wanted to solve world hunger, and he could do it.
I'm pretty sure he can take his. I'm pretty sure he can take the proceeds from his Amazon Basics line, and just continuously pay for children to go to college, for you know people to have you know not to not starve, mm-hmm. to not hurt. Could do that and not lose. I mean, not lose any. As a matter of fact, I think he would actually gain more money from it because people are like, look at that guy. He's ethical. I'm going to go spend my money over there.
Right.
Well, yeah, it certainly wouldn't require any reduction in his.
No.
His
you do life. Nothing but gain. you do nothing but gain because people want to feel that.
Yeah.
When they purchase from you, they want to feel that they're not dirty. Yeah. When they purchase from you.
Right. And it's kind of the same thing with Audible. One of the things that we've asked on the last episode that John suggested that people do is, you know, go somewhere other than Audible for your for your ebooks. What do you think about that?
Oh no, absolutely. I was going to say earlier there are other platforms that are like launching digital and Audible audiobooks type of platforms. I know that Draft Digital does. I know that who else just did one? So I know there are other ones that are launching kind of like, and have been for, they've been up for about a year or two. Mm-hmm. Just saying, hey, you know, there are other options. And that's one of the things that kind of frustrates me about the whole publishing Big Five to Big Four. It's like when you reduce the amount of places in competition, you get an Amazon or Walmart. Mm-hmm. You know, you get those huge, and then they can do whatever, or they feel like they can do whatever they want because there's no other alternative.
Right. And that becomes a huge problem. So why don't we, pivot to that a little bit. Cause what's happened recently, I guess for folks that, that aren't necessarily up on publishing stuff, this actually does, like, if you're just a reader and you're not like involved in the publishing industry, this absolutely 100% affects you too. So it's worth knowing about. So the background on it is, if you're not that familiar with publishing, it's dominated by the big five publishing houses, as they're called. You got Macmillan, Hachette, HarperCollins, Penguin Random House, and Simon & Schuster. So they just announced that Penguin Random House is buying Simon & Schuster for $2 billion, which effectively makes the big five into the big four. And that's got a lot of people upset for a lot of reasons. Nicole, do you want to elaborate on what you were just saying about why this is a bad thing?
Well, for one, there are going to be layoffs, right, for great editors, and there's that. There's layoffs that's going to happen. Anytime you have another company buy another company, there's redundancy, and so they'll lay people off. That's a problem. Two, you have an issue with lines. Certain lines will be certain lines. Like book lines or series lines would be ended, right? Because of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then so you have less choice. So your favorite, as a reader, your favorite line from Simon & Schuster may not be available anymore, right?
Are you talking about like the various imprints? Like there might be like a science fiction imprint or a fantasy mm-hmm. imprint that's part of a publishing house that publishes just like genre stuff?
Yep. Those might go away. Because if there's a similar one at Random House or wherever, mm-hmm. again, that's redundancy, or they may look at the books and be like, that's not as profitable. That's not going to fit the new image you want to move with going forward. Or they may downsize, right? Mm-hmm. So you may get less titles in that imprint. So I definitely think that, so what you have is you have a reduction of titles. You have a reduction of opportunity. You have a reduction of chances to read a diverse grouping of books because there's less publishers.
Right.
Well, and it was already a problem, right? With just five.
Yes. I mean,
we already had a problem. We don't need to make it worse by getting rid of one more. Lord.
Yeah. I it's a problem. And that also means that the competition for new authors, for existing authors to land a big four or a larger contract, that becomes tighter because there's less larger publishing houses to pitch to. It
lessens bargaining power too, right? Because if you're you don't have if you're part of the way this works, as I understand it, is that you'll have your agent if you have an agent, or you're going on your own, and you're selling your book, so you're trying to get the publishers to all want it, and you're wanting them to compete. If you have fewer alternatives for where else you could take it, that lessens your bargaining power with any one of them.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it also means that what happens in bookstores, that will change too, right? Because again, you're going to start seeing the same, because you have less stock to pull from, per se, depending on what they decide to keep from Simon & Schuster. And so your bookstores and the variety that is offered there will also change. So I just think that for you, the consumer, that will also be a little different, especially for the bookstores like Barnes & Noble and Books A Million. For your smaller bookstores too, it's a domino effect, right? And so it's going to be challenging for everyone to try to get their slice of that pie when there's less diversity and less opportunity. And I do definitely think there'll be less opportunity, only because Simon & Schuster was so large and then Random House is so large. And so when you put those two things together, there's going to be losses all around.
Right. Yeah. Penguin Random House was already the biggest, I think. Right.
And they're
buying one of the other biggest.
Yep.
So, there's a really good Washington Post article by Ron Charles that we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, where you were talking about like less diversity for the reader, like fewer choices. There's a lot that goes into that, like a lot of reasons why, like if people aren't connecting the dots on that automatically, it's like you have, if you have fewer, you have bigger companies and fewer companies, then you're going to have, there's less diversity in the editorial part, the purchasing part, the marketing part. The author of that article said, we can all read anything we want so long as it's a bestseller by John Grisham.
Right.
So that's what you end up with. That's why it's bad for the consumer. That's a reason to oppose this, because you will have less to choose from, because you'll have fewer people making the decisions. And we already probably have a pretty good idea that it's too homogenous at the top already.
What's the number? I think it's 20%. No, it might be 15% of children's books are by people of color. And so I definitely think, and so it's, I think it's 20% for adult books, maybe less. It just depends like what genre, but many, it's still a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's still, I mean, FIA puts out an annual report on publishing and its diversity and how many publishers actually publish Black authors and speculative fiction, but they also discuss publishing in general, right?
Yeah.
Just definitely think that I'm not a fan of monopolies. There's a reason why we have laws against that, right?
Right.
Remember when I'm old enough to remember when they broke up the Bells, right? And that created a lot more opportunities for little companies, right? Little telecoms to come up and do some things. We don't have that. When we have something like Random House buying Simon & Schuster, you're going to start losing the ability to have that competitive nature that drives prices down, that drives innovation, that drives creativity, because part of that is competition, right? How can we create more things to get, you know, more consumers? Well, if you don't need to compete with anybody, Amazon, then, you won't have that. You don't have to worry about that. So you walk around and it's not good for consumers. That's my thing. Like, it hurts consumers. If Amazon wants to, like, people on Amazon are already charging like a ridiculous amount of money for toilet paper, and it's not even December yet.
Yep.
There's no recourse you can go to, right? Unless there are some stores that will deliver now to you, right? You have Instacart and some other people who will bring you things. But it's still not, you still got to pay for shipping, and Amazon is free shipping. So again, the larger the corporation, the more dangerous, right? It is for the consumer, because we lose
when
companies get that big. And so readers are going to lose in a variety of ways. Right. And so
And authors definitely lose out too. There's I know the Authors Guild has come out and opposed this merger very strongly. Mm-hmm. Because that one of the things they do is they negotiate changes to the standard contracts in the industry.
Yep.
So it's not just a matter of individual sales of books and the lack of competitive options there, but it's like, it's the standard contracts across the board. This lessens the bargaining power for authors and their representatives. Like,
oh yes, 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 yes. It's a dark day for publishing.
It's not great.
No, but it also, there is a lot, I think this gives us, I remember the, again, I'm old enough to remember when the music industry was something similar, very large conglomerates of companies. This is an opportunity for people to redefine, right, publishing. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's coming.
I hope so.
I think that's what I was just thinking.
That's what we're all hoping for.
With the speed of communication that we have currently, and mm-hmm. the internet as it is now and as it's going to be in the next 10 years, I definitely see things, changing. I mean, mm-hmm. the past 4 years, the things that we've been through, we've seen substantial changes in the way we communicate, in the way we handle, things, in the way we handle business, even, especially this past year. So I agree with Nicole. I hope that, we really get to a point where we can start making things a little bit easier on the wallets of the content creators and get them paid so they can continue to do what they need to do and eat at the same time.
Right. That's crazy that hustle exists. Like, I have to, thankfully for me, I don't, unlike some people, my mortgage doesn't depend on how well Mocha Memoirs does, because I have a spouse that works. Right. But if it did, yeah. Right? Yeah. Right. And people, I taught for 18 years. I don't know why I pick professions where people don't want to pay us, but yeah. I taught for 18 years and it's the same type of vein. We educate every profession, like every profession. Without teachers, you have no professions. People can do stuff with their hands, right? But for every professional profession, that's us. We teach kids how to read. We teach right. how to do math. Like without a teacher,
yep.
these things don't exist. And they pay us peanuts, right?
Right.
So without writers, you don't have The Mandalorian. Without writers, you don't have, you know, Discovery. Without writers, you don't have these things.
You don't have any of the entertainment products you consume. Like,
right. No. None. And you don't have, you just don't have them.
And you definitely don't have any of, we've seen at least some diversity coming in, you know, in terms of seeing people of different colors and people of different, you know, genders and sexualities. And we've seen a little more here and there, and it's like, they're just poking through and it's, let's not screw it all up.
You know, what's great about
everybody doing stuff instead of going back to when, you know, you walk into a bookstore and all you see are John Grisham here and Lovecraft there and Tolkien there and good luck, you know.
Well, I mean, what's crazy about that is that, I mean, if you look at history in general, and we find Hidden Figures everywhere, there's been diversity woven into almost all the things that we have and all the things that we do. And it's been of some benefit for, I don't know, ever. So
it's always crazy. Been there. It's just it's not always, been appreciated.
Right.
And
right.
So we're seeing a tiny bit of appreciation happening. So
right.
Let's keep and, it and it's, moving.
And when we see it and it's good and we're enjoying it and stuff like this happens in Audible Gate, it really kind of gets on all of our nerves because we know it can be done better. We just don't have billions of dollars to try to open up a publishing firm and push out, you know, product like that. But we're trying to basically beat on the doors of the ivory gates, telling those guys to please fix it.
Yeah. But if you do have billions of dollars and would like to invest in a small publishing company, Nicole Gibbons Kurtz owns Mocha Memoirs Press and would be happy to speak to you.
Yes, I would.
And in the meantime, if you don't have billions of dollars, if you just have a few, still go check them out because they're all right. And Christmas is coming. So
yes.
I wanted to touch on another point with the with this consolidation with the purchase and going down to the big four publishers. I think the thing that we're really worried about, obviously, is a reduction in diversity of titles and of authors. But also one thing that this Washington Post article pointed out is that Simon & Schuster in particular has been known for publishing controversial political books. A couple examples they cited were Mary Trump's Too Much and Never Enough and John Bolton's The Room Where It Happened. Both of these books were actively and publicly opposed by the president of the United States because this is like, well, for obvious reasons, I think we all know those stories, but
yes.
So that's one thing that Simon & Schuster has done. Like even in the face of that opposition, they still publish those things. And I'm not saying they're altruistic or, you know, even politically motivated. They knew the books were going to sell, but still they did it. And the point here is that this kind of consolidation reduces the competition. And without that level of competition, it makes risk-taking like that less attractive.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I mean, in small publishers, and I'm sure John said this too, and you'll get, we take a lot of risk.
Yeah.
That's what small publishers do. I mean, a lot of the waves that you see in publishing probably started, especially in genre fiction, with small presses. Because we can afford sometimes to take those risks. Not literally, but you know, we don't have a $40,000 marketing team writing on this controversial book, right? And so think about The Martian, right? Self-published. And other texts like that. Small press publishing, we have that opportunity to do some creative and publish some really interesting works that the big five or the big four wouldn't touch because it's not, quote, a proven genre or they didn't think they could get sales off of it, right? But I definitely think that shouldn't be all shouldered on small presses. Right. And so I worry about that a lot.
Yeah, it's for sure concerning, just because they're I can't find anything really good about this, like the stuff that they've put out about the merger, of course, because they're going to have their press conferences and put out their press releases where they talk about what a great day this is for publishing and how it's just going to result in blah blah blah. I'm not even going to say the stuff they say, because it's just straight junk as far as I'm concerned. And they talk about that it's going to improve the quality of titles and everything. It's absolutely not. Like, there's no way there's no way in which a consolidation like this is going to result in them taking more risks or increasing the diversity of their titles or their group of authors looking for ways to really change the game. What they're going to do is now they'll have more power to make more money off of every individual bestseller. Mm-hmm. That's proven, and it's going to homogenize bookstores, like you said. Yep. And that just flat out pisses me off, because I don't like a homogenous bookstore. I want to find I want to find weird, interesting stuff. And we all read genre fiction quite a bit, and that especially since I think that this stands to potentially hurt genre fiction even more than what they call mainstream.
Yep.
Yeah. I just hate to see that, because I don't know. There's like not really much to be done about it, I hope, I hope that there's some pushback. There's being pushback from the Open Markets Institute, the Authors Guild. They're asking the Justice Department to challenge this deal, but who knows? I don't think they're going to bring in any antitrust stuff. It looks like it just might happen. So I guess we're talking about it because we want people to keep an eye on this. And the only thing I definitely want your perspective, all of yours, especially Nicole, but the only thing I could think of to do is keep supporting small presses. If you can oppose this merger, do that, sign a petition or whatever you can do, be public about it, but also support small presses, support the ones that if you want to keep the literary market good and interesting, then you got to support something other than the formerly Big Five, now Big Four, or soon to be Big Four.
And definitely support small bookstores too, because they usually support their local small presses. And so like without them, like I can't talk tonight.
We're all in the same boat.
Yeah, small presses, books, local bookstores, independent bookstores need you too, and only because they will buy from small presses and stock those titles in many instances where your chain stores may not. Yeah. And so I definitely think that for creative folks, definitely if you can go and support small presses and local bookstores, that would definitely help us out. That money goes right back into your community. Mm-hmm. Whereas, instead of big conglomerates, singular penny jar.
Yeah. And another thing I'd like to see is for people to, I feel like some people have the perception that the big publishers publish all the best quality stuff.
Is that true?
Let's go ahead and dispel that notion, because it's absolutely not true. All it means that it's not to say they don't publish some good stuff and some great stuff, but they don't publish all of the good stuff, not by a long shot. What they publish is the stuff that for whatever reason they believe is going to make money. And that everybody's got to be aware of some books out there that have made a ton of money and are just garbage as far as the actual quality of them. Not good books, but they
And a lot of times it's not even it's like a series, right? Like an author gets into a publisher, let's take John Grisham, whom we've decided to just completely dump on during this episode. But he's rich and he can handle it. He wrote many, many books, and they just kept publishing and kept publishing. And it's not necessarily that, hey, this, 34th book that John Grisham wrote is just a masterpiece. It's, hey, it has John Grisham's name on it. And so people will buy it because they know the damn name, right? Like that's just it. So it's not innovative. It's not necessarily amazing writing, like Jesse was saying. It's just a name on a book that will sell.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, Nicholas Sparks is another one.
Can we oh dear God.
Oh, we got lists. How about the 50, you mean
white
50
white people hugging
series?
On covers. That's what Nicholas Sparks is. He's just white people hugging on covers.
I think he's just titling his. I think he just titled his last book that just to go ahead and
yeah exactly.
But and then there's the 50 Shades of Grey series. So but my point there is that there is so much great stuff out there that's coming out from small presses that you can find in your local bookstores and stuff like that, that is absolutely on par with the stuff that the big five or four publish. It's in a lot of cases better. There is no difference in quality. So there's really no reason to rely solely on the big bookstores or on the Amazon list or anything like that. Find your local bookstore, like Nicole was saying. And typically that's where you're going to get the best recommendations too. A good bookstore knows how to find you. Like they have a lot of them, the people that run them are like book matchmakers. You tell them the kind of stuff you like, they'll find you something you've never heard of that you're going to love. That's awesome. You know, take advantage of that and support people other than Penguin Random House and Simon and Schuster in the process. Exactly. Yeah. Well, we had there's one other thing I wanted to that we wanted to talk about because we wanted to end on a positive note here, which is some news that just came out earlier today. We just kind of wanted to shout out Nalo Hopkinson, author and editor who was just named science fiction and fantasy writer of America's 37th Grandmaster.
Yep.
That is amazing.
This is a huge honor. It's something given to really the greats that have worked in this field of genre fiction, and she absolutely deserves it. So so big shout out to Nalo Hopkinson. That's a happy note to end on after it all the, after all the rest of
after all the things that we've been, after the journey we've just taken. That's a fantastic note to end on. Congratulations. We appreciate Nicole Givens Kurtz for joining us here today. Thank you very much for joining us. We hope that this doesn't affect you too much, and we hope that we can sort of find a solution to this whole thing with Amazon, and they can start actually paying people. And thank you everybody for joining us here on Glitchy Pancakes. We hope you're full. If you want to find us, you can find us at glitchypancakes.com. Subscribe to us through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, CastBox, any of your favorite podcasts and apps. You can follow us on Twitter. Nicole, real quick, where can they find you on social media?
You can find me on Twitter at Nicole G. Kurtz. And you can find Mocha Memoirs at Mocha Memoirs on Twitter. And then you can find us on Facebook with the same and Instagram with those same handles.
Nice. And you can find us if you want to email anything to us, suggestions or anything like that, you can catch us at cakespod@gmail.com. Jesse, where can we find you on the various social media platforms?
I'm on Twitter more than anywhere else probably, and I'm at Jesse_A_Adams.
Right. And Allie, where can we check you out on the social media platforms as well?
You can pretty much find me on any platform at Allie911. That's Allie 911.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Just one more thing. Everybody who is listening, if you haven't already, cancel your Audible subscription and send them a note to tell them that you're canceling because they aren't being transparent in reporting.
Right. Okay. 100%.
Sorry.
They'll know what you're talking about.
They'll know exactly what you're talking about. They've covered it. They'll know.
Yep.
And you can find me on Twitter, fighting a good fight at EI Blackout. That's IAIBLACKOUT. I had fun. Again, thanks, Nicole Givens for Givens Kurtz for joining us. Allie and Jesse, love you guys. Thank you for joining us here at Glitchy Pancakes. We love you guys. We'll see you next time.
Bye, thanks, you guys. Everybody.